Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
All this week, we have been checking in with New Hampshire, where candidates are campaigning ahead of Tuesday's presidential primary. Well, today, one of those candidates declared victory in Iowa.
So what I want to do today, 3 days late, is to thank the people of Iowa for the very strong victory they gave us at the Iowa caucuses on Monday night.
That is Senator Bernie Sanders this afternoon at his campaign headquarters in Manchester. And Radio Boston's Chris Siderick is there for us. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Tiziana.
So press conference was a late add to the schedule, but luckily you were there. So can you bring us into the room?
Yeah, it was interesting. The press release went out a few minutes before 11. It originally was scheduled for noon. That got pushed back to 1, but everyone was scrambling, not just members of the media setting up cameras and things, but members of the campaign. They were trying to get all the signage up and everything set. I got to say, it was a real glimpse into how meticulous these events are planned. So, there was one volunteer that spent maybe 20 or 30 minutes ironing the New Hampshire state flag, so I thought that was interesting. But anyway, a few minutes after 1 o'clock, Senator Sanders walked in. He immediately declared victory, as you just heard, and then he basically opened up the floor for questions from the media. And throughout the process, there was a definite sense that he had a clear frustration with the Iowa Democratic Party.
What has happened with the Iowa Democratic Party is an outrage, that they were that unprepared, that they put forth such a complicated process, relied on untested technology.
Seems like there's another challenge there, Chris, because didn't somebody else, as in Pete Buttigieg, already declare victory in Iowa a couple days ago?
Yeah, he did. Interestingly enough, he did that when a whopping 0% of the results had been reported, and he then later walked that back a little bit and kind of said it was more of a victory over expectations. But Senator Sanders was asked about that, essentially why people should believe him over Pete when talking about who won the Iowa caucus. Here's what he said.
Why should people believe your victory speech over his?
Because I got 6,000 more votes. And from where I come, when you get 6,000 more votes, that's generally regarded to be the winner.
So he also went on to talk about the confusion of the Iowa caucus process. In the past, it's been all about state delegate equivalence. The person who gets the most SDEs is declared the winner. This was the first time that they've released the popular vote, and that's what he's talking about there, getting 6,000 more votes. He said the media should be more focused on the national delegates and that essentially the entire system needs to change as well.
So obviously he was taking questions. What else was he asked about?
One of the things he seemed most passionate about during the press conference was the DNC's decision to change the debate rules, which will allow Michael Bloomberg to participate down the road. Keep in mind, there had been these standards of a certain number of donations and certain polling numbers. They've removed the donation requirement because Michael Bloomberg has said he is self-funding his campaign, not taking any donors. Here's Senator Sanders talking about the rule change.
And now suddenly, a guy comes in who does not campaign one bit in Iowa, New Hampshire. He's not on the ballot, I guess, in Nevada or South Carolina. But he's worth $55 billion. And I guess if you're worth $55 billion, you can get the rules changed.
He went on to say it was totally unfair to candidates like Tulsi Gabbard, Cory Booker, Andrew Yang, who've put in the time and the work on the ground to campaign in all of these early states. And I think it's also important to keep in mind this is a candidate who has said he felt the 2016 process was unfair, that the party had rigged the system against him, and has leveled criticism at them in the past as well.
So to that point, yesterday we had Vice President Joe Biden going after Sanders, saying that Trump would love to pin the socialist label on the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders not technically a member of the party. Did he respond to that?
He did, not actually specifically to Biden, though. He was asked about Joe Biden's comments, and he spun that into a chance to talk about what he thinks it's actually going to take to win against Donald Trump.
At the end of the day, in order to defeat Donald Trump, who will be a very formidable opponent, we are going to need an unprecedented grassroots movement of folks who are prepared to knock on doors and do all of the things that our supporters did in Iowa, and they're doing right here in New Hampshire, and they're doing right now in California, and in Nevada, and South Carolina, and all across this country.
So, Chris, I just want to ask you really quickly, was this predominantly for him today a focus on process, horse race, what's happening in Iowa, et cetera? Did he talk about issues or his agenda? What was his focus here?
It was interesting. I would say today marked a little bit of a turning point in terms of tone. He talked a lot about the general election matchup with Donald Trump. He didn't talk about his Democratic competitors other than the one mentioned during the conversation about the debate rules. It felt like a candidate who was trying to make the turn to now front-runner status, trying to look ahead to the general. It was an interesting shift in tone from him.
And I do want to stay on this kind of the horse race and process part for a minute longer, because a big part of Higgs' argument is that he's going to turn out new voters. Iowa doesn't look like that happened. There wasn't a huge increase of turnout. So did he address that?
He did. He said he was disappointed. He was pretty open and honest about that. But he said he was encouraged by the fact that there was an increase in the youth vote, actually. He said that's a big part of his campaign's success, and he takes hope from that.
All right,
if we can mobilize, and Iowa is a good start in that process, if we can mobilize and bring young people into the political process, I think it will have a very positive and profound impact on the general election.
So you talked to some young people today. You were at St. Anselm. What did you hear from them?
It was interesting. Yesterday, I covered the Youth Climate and Clean Energy Town Hall. Today, I just went to the St. Anselm campus, walked around, talked to kids who were walking around between classes or headed to the administrative office or whatever. And I got kind of mixed results in terms of how plugged into the process they were, how much they were following the race. I only found one student who said they thought they knew pretty much who they were going to vote for. That was Spencer Rose. He was a 19-year-old freshman from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. He said he's voting for Trump.
I feel like he's truthful. I'm going to say that. But I feel like when he says something, he's going to get it done. And I know he's done well for the economy. I think that's for like the people I work for back home. They really like him because they invest in stocks and stuff, and their stocks are doing very well.
I would say most of the students I talked to, rather than candidate-based, their preferences were issue-based. For example, I talked to Janelle Fassi. She was a junior from Goffstown, New Hampshire. Here's what she said she's thinking about as she's weighing the candidates.
I would say prescription drugs, health care, especially because my dad is coming, like, our well-son's plan has kind of ceased to exist, and so now he has to pay for his medications, and it's like $2,500, so it's really expensive.
Before I let you go, let me just ask, because you did mention that you spent yesterday with young people at a climate change forum. Any big themes or messages from there? Because we aren't still hearing a ton about climate change in this race.
Yeah, it's definitely important, especially to the younger crowd, it seems. One of the really interesting things I've noticed now talking to folks who were super plugged into the issue, like at the town hall yesterday, compared to students who are just wandering around campus who I'm running up to and shoving a microphone in their face, a lot of folks are more concerned with how a candidate presents themselves. Do they relate to the voters? Are they empathetic? Do they seem to understand the problems and issues that are facing Americans rather than specific stances necessarily on issues? And I think that is a kind of a theme you see in New Hampshire traditionally, because they have the chance to interact with these candidates on kind of a personal level in a lot of cases.
All right. That is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick in Manchester, New Hampshire. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Massachusetts State House continues to struggle with its own place in the Me Too movement. In 2017, a Boston Globe columnist reported interviews revealing a culture of pervasive sexual harassment there. In 2018, Senate President Stan Rosenberg resigned over a sexual harassment scandal involving his husband. Then that same year, Diana DeSaglio, then a state representative, revealed that she had experienced sexual harassment as a staffer. She joined a growing movement of women by breaking her non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, in a speech on the House floor. She's since been pushing for legislation that would end government use of NDAs for sexual harassment. Last week, former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson, who signed an NDA over sexual harassment and whose story is featured in the Oscar-nominated film Bombshell, joined DeSaglio for a press conference touting the legislation. But this week, the Joint Judiciary Committee submitted the bill for study, all but assuring it won't move forward. We caught up with Diana DeSaglio, now state senator from Methuen, from the road in her district, to hear her reaction to the news.
I am deeply disappointed that a bill that is such a common sense piece of legislation was sent to study over working on the bill and passing it out of the committee. I don't think that we need a study at all to know that it's wrong to use taxpayer dollars to cover up the potentially corrupt and abusive behaviors of elected officials, their staff, or public agencies.
So you feel that the bill, as you have designed it, provides the appropriate privacy and protections for potential victims without using taxpayer money to cover up misdeeds of perpetrators?
Yes. There's also a provision in the bill that I filed that allows a victim at any time to privately request a non-disclosure agreement if they so choose. The bill is simply meant to make sure that these silencing agreements are not forced on victims. And the excuses that we heard, to me, they're excuses. We have a bill in the committee. The bill should have been worked on. If they had a problem with the details of the language, that's their job to work on those details and to make sure that we can come up with something that carries forward the intent of the legislation.
Let me just jump in there for a minute, State Senator, because we do know that now the bill has been sent to the from committee for study. There is a criticism in Beacon Hill that that's where bills go to die. Are you concerned that this is a death blow for your bill in this session?
I am concerned about that when it comes to the House of Representatives. However, I have been in conversations with the Senate President and with the chair on the Senate side of the Judiciary Committee, who both have committed to me that they're going to be giving their absolute best efforts to see these important reforms passed on the Senate side. Unfortunately, the exact opposite has been said when it comes to the Speaker of the House and the House of Representatives.
So the Speaker has said that the House has new rules in place about NDAs and that those are informed by best practices from organizations like the National Association to End Sexual Violence and the Boston Rape Crisis Center. Why do you feel that those reforms aren't adequate or sufficient?
Well, because the Speaker has said time and time again that he's only giving out these non-disclosure agreements at the request of the victim. And having been someone who was required by the Speaker to sign a non-disclosure agreement, I was not given the option. It was required of me that I sign a non-disclosure agreement. And the current policies that are in place have so many loopholes that we cannot continue to claim that our victim has the option to request one. That's simply not true.
I do need to note just for the record that the Speaker disputes the idea that he was aware that there was a sexual harassment dimension to your NDA and that he forced you to sign it. I just need to note that for the record. I want to move on. This comes in a larger context of the Massachusetts State House having been embroiled in the Me Too movement. Has any progress been made? And are you encouraged by any progress if you've seen some?
Yes, I mean, I'm encouraged by the fact that we did see the passage of a provision that I filed at the beginning of this session in January, passed in the state Senate, where the state Senate unanimously agreed to pass a proposal of mine to ban the use of taxpayer dollars from being used to silence victims within the state Senate. That was supported by every Democrat and every Republican, and there was no debate about it. There were only comments of support. But we need to ensure that it's passed through the House and gets on the governor's desk. Your taxpayer dollars should not be going towards covering up potentially abusive or corrupt activities across the board in Massachusetts.
And we did reach out to Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo's office for his response. We did not hear back. This week, Boston Public School educators are engaging in a week of action around racial justice as part of a nationwide effort called Black Lives Matter at School. Adopted by the Boston Teachers Union, the initiative includes lessons about the guiding principles of structural racism, Black identity and history, and the tenets of the Black Lives Matter movement. The president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association issued a letter protesting the week of action in the schools and calling Black Lives Matter an, quote, anti-police organization, end quote. The letter also urges Boston Teachers Union President Jessica Tang to reconsider the union's decision to support Black Lives Matter. Jessica Tang is on the phone with us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jessica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And to help us have this conversation, we also have on the line Eddie Crispin, president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, also known as MAMLEO. Eddie, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And on the line is former Boston Police Chief Daniel Linsky, who's now managing director for Kroll, a security risk management practice, and a fellow at the Duff and Phelps Institute. Welcome back, Chief.
Thanks for having me.
And I do want to note, we reached out to the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association and Boston Police Commissioner William Gross to join us today, but we didn't hear back from either of them in time for this segment. Before we start, we also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Is it appropriate to be focusing on a Black Lives Matter-oriented set of actions and curriculums in the school? Does the Boston Police Union have a point in making an objection to it? What do you think? Join the conversation. Okay, so we talked a little bit about the letter, and I do want to get to that soon. But before we do, Jessica, I think it would be helpful to just hear what is happening in the schools this week and who's doing it.
Sure. So just as way of background, this is actually being organized by actually over 40 different cities, education in 40 different cities. And it started in Seattle. And I think the background is necessary for understanding why this came to be and what the goals are of the Week of Action. And in short, it started in Seattle at an elementary school where there was an event to called Black Men Uniting to Change the Narrative and Celebrating Black History and Black Lives Matter. And as a result of that event, there was a bomb threat sent to the school. And so thousands of educators then later, as part of the racial justice work we do in schools, wanted to stand in solidarity with that school. And so they had a day of action. And this day of action has since 2016 grown into a week of action. It spread to other places like Philadelphia.
So, Jessica, what does that mean, a week of action? Help people understand what's happening and where and by whom.
Sure. So educators, you know, are coming together to teach about inclusivity, about
and empathy. Are they teaching students in classrooms, or is this teaching each other in professional development?
It's actually both. And so if you, and this I think is important too, is that there seems to be a conflation of, you know, this being BLM, so it must be anti-police, and that's not what it's about at all. In fact, if you go to the Black Lives Matter at Schools website, you'll see what the suggested lesson plans are and what the values are. And, you know, for example, day one is about restorative justice, loving empathy, and loving engagement. And so, you know, we're trying to teach students, you know, what is restorative justice? If you do something that harms somebody, instead of just saying sorry and walking away, how do you actually repair the harm that's done and how do you make better choices? That's what restorative justice is about, for example.
All right. So I think that gives us a little bit of a sense of what you're working on this week. And we will come back more to the curriculum. But before we do that, to finish out the context of our conversation, now I want to turn our attention to the letter. We cannot get the full letter from the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. We did reach out to them. There was an excerpt in the Boston Globe, and that excerpt reads, quote, "Policing has always been a dangerous profession, but groups like Black Lives Matter, by inaccurately demonizing police as racists who kill innocent people, have made policing more dangerous than ever before," end quote. Chief Linsky, let me bring in you in next here. What is your reaction to that letter, especially in regards to what you just heard from Jessica Tang?
Yeah, so my reaction is, you know, I think it's always better to have a conversation before you put pen to paper. And I think what Michael was writing from is, you know, unless you've met with and sat down with Black Lives Matter members who are trying to move the engagement down the field, you might have the misperception that it's the Black Lives Matter that plays out in social media, where in fact individuals try and radicalize, you know, what are peaceful people trying to change things and engage in conversations where they're threatening police officers. You know, we've seen video of police officers, people chanting about, you know, frying pigs like bacon. And if that's the experience you have and you don't know the other side of the movement where there are good people doing the right thing, trying to change our conversation and change the way we police ourselves and keep our community safe, well, including the communities of color in that conversation, you might tend to think that, you know, you need to write the letter as quickly as possible. I wish, you know, maybe a conversation could have occurred between the two presidents beforehand to see what the curriculum was, what was going to be on it before there was a letter put to paper. Because in the end, the police officers I know have the same goals as the leaders of Black Lives Matter, who are trying to teach kids and teach our society about disparate impacts the current policing system has on communities of color.
So let's.
But I think.
Well, I'd like to just. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
But I think a lot of people think, you know, police are responsible for unconscious bias in society, and there are definitely prejudiced police officers, like there's prejudiced teachers, like there's prejudiced talk show hosts. But the majority of the cops don't have prejudices, but do, like every human being, have an unconscious bias. And because of that, we need to develop systems where we don't get our feelings hurt when someone criticizes us. We look at the data and figure out a solution going forward jointly together on how to make things better.
All right, Eddie, let me turn to you now. Mamlio put out a joint statement with the Boston chapter of the NAACP in support of the Boston Teachers Union doing this. So what is your take on the letter and the situation that we're in at this moment?
Well, I think what's concerning to me is that, even before I found out about the letter, a number of my members started calling me because they were somewhat bothered by the letter and that it depicted them as part of the 1,400 members of the BPPA, and that they felt like they were being portrayed as having the same mindset, the same perspective on Black Lives Matter, whereas many of them, actually every single person that called me, does not agree in any way with the union president's take on Black Lives Matter. Every single person that called me, aligns themselves with Black Lives Matter, despite the fact they're police officers. I think the takeaway should have been, let's have a conversation. I think a lot of them were in the schools. They interact with young kids who may have anti-police sentiments, but the idea is always to have a conversation and change their minds. I think by trying to silence the conversation, that's the problematic part for me.
Jessica, do you agree?
The silencing of any conversation that can lead to productive dialogue, yes, I find problematic as well. And again, that's part of the reason that we are doing this, is to spark dialogue, conversations, understanding, learning, and of course to affirm our Black students, Black educators, and Black families that we work with.
So what is at odds here? Let's talk about this for a second, because I mean, this is a conversation that our American community, our Boston community, has been engaged in for a while now. And it feels like what's being pitted here is the safety and efficacy of police officers and the rights of people to claim and teach about systemic bias and long-term oppression of Black Americans. Do those things need to be at odds or in tension? Chief Linsky?
So I think there's an educational piece. And myself, when groups would come out and say, hey, you guys racially profile people of color and communities of color, I would say, we absolutely don't. I don't know police officers who leave the station and say, I'm going to get this person because of the color of their skin, their sexuality, their age. And when someone says to you that you do that, that must mean that you're part of a racist class, right?
But there has been a history of racial profiling in policing more broadly.
Let me continue. However, when you look at the stats, you see, wait a minute, there's a problem here. There is a challenge here. Maybe we're not all consciously doing policing where it negatively impacts the community. We're not doing racial profiling, but unconsciously we certainly are. And the police are the end of that spear. Sometimes they're getting out of the police cars and approaching people, and they make decisions based on the color of their skin. They may make decisions based on that they've seen this person involved in activity before. Or a lot of times I think the unconscious bias is bigger than us. We respond to 911 calls where people say there's a suspicious kid outside my house. And the reason he's suspicious is he doesn't look like the other kids in the neighborhood. There's no filter for police to not take that call. We respond to that call, and we have to engage that kid and say, hey, what are you doing here? And he says, I just moved in. We're the ones who are on the end of that, and we're the ones who are delivering that bias. But that bias is in society, not just law enforcement. I think it's educating law enforcement on that, and it's educating the community on law enforcement's general desire to do the right thing from most cops that I've ever worked with.
Let's add a caller voice here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Michael's on the line from Dedham. Michael, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a elementary school teacher in a small local school district, and I've been following the developments of Black Lives Matter at school online and really excited about it, but nervous and reluctant to push anything forward in my district, because I feel that the dynamics between schools and the community and local police are so different in a smaller town as opposed to in a city like Boston.
Okay, thanks for that, Michael. I'm actually going to add another caller in here. We've got Chris on the line from Roslindale. Chris, go ahead.
Yes, so I'm the 2015 National Elementary Social Studies Teacher of the Year.
Congratulations,
Chris. And social studies I say that because nationally, we need to encourage teachers to teach real history and the experience of the children we're teaching. And Black Lives Matter is simply saying we need to understand the experience of black people. And I want to also point out that the BPPA is, if you read their own publications, is clearly has racist bias. Read Pax Centaurian. That's their publication. Read their description of Obama. Read their description.
Okay, Chris,
of
I'm going to pick it up from there because I want to make sure that we've got time for responses. Eddie, I'd love to invite you.
So let me speak to that. I don't disagree with the caller. I think there's a history there in the union as it being a predominantly white male-oriented institution. Its leadership has always historically been white, right? And I know myself and a number of other members of MAMLU have complained to the union about the scant of a lot of the articles and even some of the postings that have been, and even some of the candidates that they've endorsed. Problem being that very few times are any of the officers of color consulted, right? So that's another, that's a whole different issue. But if we want to stick to this issue of Black Lives Matter, I'm looking at this pamphlet. I think it might have been a knee-jerk reaction, right? It says it has these four demands for Black Lives Matter Education Week: zero tolerance, discipline, and implementing restorative justice, hiring more black teachers, mandating black history and ethnic studies and K-12 curriculum, fund counselors, not cops, and then that's really the bulk of it. So for me, I don't have any issues with any of those. I would like to engage in a further conversation with the part about funding counselors, not cops, because obviously there's a need for both of them, right?
Well, so we've got Jessica right here. Let's do a little of that engagement. Jessica, Eddie, tell Jessica what you're thinking there, and Jessica, I invite you to respond.
So my thinking is this. Police officers respond to schools on a daily basis. We have police officers who are in the schools who do a lot of the investigation, engage with the children in the school and serve as mentors, coaches, teachers, et cetera. The idea that we should not have police officers is flawed, and I think it needs further investigation, but I think it's a conversation worth having. Absolutely, we need more counselors, but the idea of not funding cops at all, police officers, we go to schools. There's a school right down the street. The last few days, they've been having problems. So the people who have responded have been police officers who are assigned to the school police unit and police officers assigned to the district. There's clearly a need for it, but I think, again, for me, that's not the biggest issue. I think we have to look at it as a whole and see that it is absolutely necessary to have these kind of conversations.
All right, let's grab Jessica. Jessica, please.
Sure. So I want to be clear, too. The national, I think, demand of fund counselors was around the idea that a lot of times when there's a problem in schools, there is a knee-jerk reaction, you know, to call the police. But what happens, and this is speaking to what we call the school-to-prison pipeline, is oftentimes a disturbance at a school assembly, for example, we think should be handled in-house by, the school, and in using, again, practices like restorative practices where we figure out, you know, like, what is the behavior? What is the root of that behavior? How do we repair the harm, as opposed to getting that student involved in, you know, the criminal justice system, which then often, again, leads to further problems. And so I think that was the intent, was to say, hey, you know, it's not to say we don't have, issues in schools. It's not to say there's not an important role for first responders and police, but when we have limited funds and we have schools, you know, who have to pick between a librarian and a counselor or, you know, a special ed teacher or a phys ed teacher, that we want to emphasize the importance of funding counselors. We don't have a counselor in all of our schools in Boston Public Schools right now.
So Jessica,
that was the intent. It was never meant, I think, to be derogatory in nature or to say that there's no role for police officers. And I think maybe that's where the misunderstanding comes from.
So I want to be mindful of time. We've only got about 2 minutes left, and I want to hear from all three panelists one more time. I know that out there is a caller saying that an emphasis on Black Lives Matter means that we're failing to emphasize the fact that everyone's lives matters. That's often an answer we hear to Black Lives Matter is all lives matter. Where is the appropriate emphasis as we have a dialogue about law enforcement and race in Boston on the history of the black experience versus a broader empathy that we need to teach our young people?
Yeah. So for me, I will say this.
Go ahead, Eddie, and then Chief Linsky.
I think it's important to have some historical perspective on this issue, right? And my letter that I, and a joint statement I put out with the NAACP, and the letter I sent to the BPP, president spoke to that. There's a lot of history of black and brown people and poor people being mistreated by law enforcement in this country. No one can deny that. And to some extent, and also speaking to what the chief was speaking about earlier, about how we're just a microcosm of society, right? Society has all these biases.
Eddie, I'm just going to push you on time because we're running short.
Just real quickly, again, we have to look at the historical perspective, and then we also have to look at the way society views people. Until we get to the point where we no longer have those biases, and unless we can erase the history, we have to have a conversation.
Thanks. And Chief Linsky, 30 seconds tops. What do you got?
Yes, so this was a missed opportunity for both sides. We can't have we need to have this conversation with kids in school about the history and how police have negatively impacted communities of color. We need to include the police in that conversation. We all have our own sides. We need to check our egos, come to the table. We all have the same goals. We want to keep kids safe and police people professionally. And everyone that I know of who's involved in this conversation has that same goal. It was a missed opportunity to have that conversation before the letter went out. However, we can make it an opportunity now and get all sides to the table to figure out the best solution and how we talk to our kids and how we police our communities.
All right, that's former Boston Chief Police Chief Daniel Linsky, who's now a managing director for Kroll, a security risk management practice. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We had Jessica Chang, president of the Boston Teachers Union. Jessica Chang, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Eddie Crispin, president of the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers, also known as MAMLEO. Eddie, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
The date, February 6th, 1978. The time, 1,800 hours off the coast of Salem, Massachusetts. The 685-foot Greek oil tanker, the Global Hope, is dragging anchor as a blizzard bears down on New England, a storm that would later be known as the blizzard of 1978, a once-in-a-century storm.
Global Hope, this is Gloucester Coast Guard Station. Send your traffic, please.
A recording there of the moment the tanker radioed shore, quote, "We are in danger. Our windshield is broken and water is coming into our engine room," end quote. Thus, the lives of 33 men on board are at risk. The U.S. Coast Guard jumped into action, dispatching their rescue boats, a 44 and a 95-footer from Gloucester and Boston. The 95-foot cutter struggled to make progress in the 40-foot seas and blinding wind and snow. The 44-footer ran into trouble, too, losing radar and thus their ability to see. Listening to the radio communications was Frank Quirk, Jr. of Gloucester, the captain of a 50-foot pilot boat, the Can Do. He called in his crew, and they took to the raging waters to see if conditions were right for them to be of service to their fellow seamen in the Coast Guard.
Southbound Gloucester 317, negative radar, negative satellometer, and no vehicle light, over. Gloucester 317, roger out.
Gloucester Station 317, negative, sir. Visibility is probably 30 feet. We have nothing in sight at this time, over.
But they thought this was a run-of-the-mill New England blizzard, and it quickly became clear that it was anything but.
This is not a drill. A mayday. Over.
Fireboat can do Gloucester Station. Roger, we have you.
Good time.
Gloucester Station, keep sending your traffic over.
You can do, Gloucester Station can do.
That was Charlie Bucco on the Can Do. Charlie was a former Coast Guardman helping Frank Quirk during this attempted rescue. He was the one who said, "Mayday, mayday, mayday, this is not a drill, this is not a drill."
That's Michael Togas, author of the new book for young readers, Into the Blizzard, Heroism at Sea During the Great Blizzard of 1978. Togas tells the story of how the Can Do set off on what it thought was an ordinary winter rescue mission and got lost in the waves.
They don't really know where they are, but they're in extreme danger. Charlie says, "We're trying to get into deeper water here." Station Gloucester goes, "Keep talking." And Charlie goes, "We're in shoal water. Our windshield is out. Position unknown. Action extremely violent." The last message began to explain what happened to the Can Do. It had hit a shoal or shallow water, either the ocean's bottom or a rock ledge. At the same moment, the windshield was blown out, probably from a giant wave. The wall of water, parts of the windshield, and the motor from the spinning window crashed into Frank's head, knocking him from the wheel. Because Charlie was likely standing by the wheel with Frank, he too would have been sent reeling backward, arms flailing, by the booming fist of water.
That's the story Togas tells in his new adaptation of his best-selling book, 10 Hours Till Dawn.
It's important for any listener to understand they had been Frank Quirk, the captain of the Can-Do, and Charlie Bucco, who was on board, had done many rescues, one just a year earlier in a blizzard when an oil tanker split in half. So they went out to try and escort that lost Coast Guard boat, check in on the oil tanker, see if there was anything they could do. And they, too, lost their radar because of the giant seas and hurricane force winds. A lot of times people go, what the heck were they doing out in the blizzard of 78? I always say, well, first, they didn't know this was going to turn into the storm of the century. It was exploding upon them at the time. And second, they had a lot of experience in just the year before in an eerily similar situation. They were able to save 6 out of 7 men on board.
I want to go back and emphasize something you just said, which is we now know what the blizzard of 1978 was. But as it was emerging in that February, people didn't. They didn't have any idea of the disaster that was barreling down on them. What made this storm so deadly and so particular, as you said, a storm of the century?
The main issue was it stalled in place, and the height of waves is a formation of wind speed, the open fetch of the ocean, and the duration of the wind. So those all combine to make the ocean so troublesome for anybody along the coast, and hundreds of homes were demolished from this storm. And, of course, inland, most people remember all the cars stuck on the major highways.
Just paint a little bit more of the picture of what the seas these men were facing were like that night.
The winds were coming out of the northeast, so as they left Gloucester to head down towards Salem Sound, which is where this oil tanker was last seen, they'd be going with these giant seas. So if you could imagine the seas pushing them along on the stern. And when the Can-Do lost its radar, they did make the right decision. I've run this by many mariners, that the key is to stay in deep water, try to find your way back to safety. So they turned back towards Gloucester, but now they're going into these giant waves, which have grown to approximately 40 feet. And our theory, the captain's son and I, we both think that while the men on the Can-Do think they're heading back north to Gloucester, the waves are actually pushing them backwards, even with engine power running.
You know, when you write about the men on the Can-Do, there's a sense of awe in the way that you talk about them, especially Frank Quirk. Tell us a little bit about Frank Quirk in your eyes.
I think a lot of my respect for Frank came with the way he handled himself, both in rescues before the blizzard and in non-rescues. For example, if somebody ran out of gas out on the ocean, Frank, it might be his day off, and he'd be the one to go out there, give the person gas, help a commercial fishing boat. They'd say, what do we owe you? He'd say, nothing, maybe throw me a fish next time. And then during the storm, I gained all new respect, because on the radio, he's even tempered, even when he knows the chances aren't good that they're going to make it. You never hear panic in his voice. You never hear shouting. He's giving as much information as he can to the Coast Guard in hopes that they'll locate him with these bigger cutters.
You say in the book that you think some of that is sort of his temperament and training, but some of that is him being aware that his own family could be listening, or probably were listening through a radio at home. That was kind of a sucker punch of a thought. Was his family listening, and did you have a chance to hear from them about what they were going through?
Yes. His daughter Maureen said in the beginning, while we listened, we thought this was another routine effort by Dad to assist the Coast Guard. And she said when they got to the Mayday and everything's going wrong, she said, I unplugged it. I could not let my mother listen to any more.
Charlie sounds different than the way that you described Frank when he says, Mayday, Mayday, this is not a drill. What would one expect of a human being in those moments?
Knowing that they lost their windshield as they did, Charlie's got a shout to be heard above the wind and the seas. And, you know, Charlie, I came away with such respect as well. And I often thought, he's one of the most charismatic people I've ever researched and written about. He had two Purple Hearts from Vietnam. And just, you know, the little stories I would hear about him, you know, he just came back, he got a brand new coat, he goes by a homeless guy, and he goes, he needs this more than I do. And off goes the brand new coat rather than give the guy $5. Was this incredible free spirit after he returned from Vietnam in terms of trying all sorts of different occupations, from acting, he was really handsome, to being a cowboy. And then he kind of found a home in the Coast Guard. He was serving in the Coast Guard just prior to the blizzard. As I mentioned, that rescue a year earlier was the oil tanker Chester Poling. It was a very dangerous rescue Charlie was involved in. And he said to his fiance Sharon, I don't want to make you a widower. Planning to have a family, so I'm going to leave the Coast Guard, which he did. But when he got the call from Frank, of course, he couldn't say no. The men on the 44 were men that Charlie had trained. Of course, he was going to give it a try.
What happened to the boat?
The boat was off of the Gooseberry Islands, which would be south of Baker's Island, off of Salem. And after that May Day, it lost engine power later in the night, and then all communication was lost. And then surprisingly, a private radio operator came on the air, and he said, I can still hear Frank. And Frank had described that they lost engine power, so they dropped anchor. That would be the only way to keep the bow into the seas. That bought them more time, but eventually the seas were too much. The anchor chain would have parted. And once that happened, we know, because later the boat was found, we know that it rolled along the bottom of the ocean all the way south to Marblehead.
And there were no survivors.
There were no survivors. There was hope for a long period of time about finding Charlie alive, because he was not found with the others in the first few days after the blizzard.
You wrote this version of this story for young adults. What do you want young adults to learn from it? What do you want them to take from it?
Well, the first thing is getting kids to read again. But then I also want them to learn from these, I guess we could call them heroes. They're flawed people. They're not superheroes. They're afraid, just like you and I might be, but somehow, where I might be incapacitated by my fear, these people know how to keep it in check and still do the job. And they just kind of focus these people that get through the impossible. And oftentimes, even if they don't think they're going to make it, they have a mindset. And one of them verbalized this to me, who did survive. He said, I thought I was going to die, but I'm going to go down fighting.
Why do kids need to wrestle with that level of heavy life and death, terror and courage?
I think there's some points that these special people in the books use that we could all use when we're faced with adversity. A couple that come to mind is, before any big decision is made, they usually pause and they say, what's different about this situation than something that was similar? And then the other is they tend to rely on their gut instinct, we might call it intuition, subconscious clues that you can't articulate yet, but they're pushing you in one direction or another. They don't waste energy on saying, for example, how did I get in this jam? I can't believe I screwed up and I did this. They're just focused on the now.
This is a story of heroism, but it is also a gut-wrenching, heartbreaking tragedy. we discover in the end that the tanker really wasn't in distress and no one needed to go out.
Isn't that ironic that they started it all? They were only in 20 feet of water on Coney Island Ledge where their stern was pushed to. And the first person that was helicoptered down, you know, he rappelled down to it, Barry Chambers, he was with the Atlantic Strike Team. He said, I was just furious at the captain because I had followed all this. And then to go on and see that all 33 men on board were absolutely fine. The vessel was in no danger of breaking apart. He said, my disgust was made quite evident to that captain.
You could have written this story as a tragedy. You didn't. I would argue you wrote it as a triumph. Did you do that because that's what we need today? Or did you do that because that's the way you tell a story like this to young adults? Or was there some other reason you focused on the triumph even in this maddening tragedy?
I think it came back to Frank's words on that initial time where I listened to the first time I listened to the audio tape and pulled my car over on 128 to keep listening. He said early on to the Coast Guard, okay, we're going to give it our best shot. In other words, you know, he later said, you know, we may be right back. It may be too bad to go. And I just think that was the way he looked at it. He couldn't sit there and hear that these four young Coast Guard men were in trouble on the 44-footer, that he had to give it his best shot. And that, you know, when I talked to his son and his daughter about that, they said, yeah, that was a line my dad used. And I thought, what a great way to live your life. When other people step back because of fear, you're going to try to do the right thing and be helpful.
Michael Togas is the author of numerous books, including The Finest Hours, A Storm Too Soon, and 10 Hours Until Dawn. His latest, an adaptation for young readers of 10 Hours, is Into the Blizzard. Michael Togas, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tiziana. I appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.